Hi, welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. We are back, and I am really excited. I can't tell you how excited I am about my new guest. And you might know him a little bit. You know, you might be a little familiar with this guy, but I'm very familiar with him, and we're going to be talking with him about his latest publication. It's a wonderful book of stories from the wall titled Kafka in a Skirt. And of course, he is also known, a.k.a., also known as my co-host, Daniel Chacon. Yay!
Welcome. There was much rejoicing. Yay!
There was much rejoicing all along the frontera and beyond. Hey, man, no, in all seriousness, I'm really excited to talk with you about this book. As you know, I've read all of your books, except for Hotel Juarez, which I only read like two of the stories in there. But other than that, I've read all the other books.
You should go back. It's a good book.
I should.
You know, I think what you've done is you've read percentages of my book.
No. Percentages. Wow. That's, you know, we're going to get into that conversation.
We do that sometimes.
That's true. Yeah. We do. We read
like for example, what is it called? Breathing in Dust. I think I've read...
Just the dust?
30% of it.
You only read the dust part of it?
30%, but I read 100% of the rest.
Yeah, huh? Well, that's great. Well, actually, believe it or not, this time, Daniel, I read 100% of Kafka in a Skirt, only to arrive here because the copy I got is the advanced reading copy, the ones that we typically get here from authors. But now that I've read 100% of your book, I arrive here and you tell me that actually the version I have is the uncorrected proof version.
And so yes, it's the virgin version.
The virgin version.
Yeah, and in fact, there might even be some stories that are not in this one that are in the last one.
Wow.
You know, what was really cool with the press? Okay. The press was very patient with me when I wanted to make changes. And I said, you know, I think this one belongs. So even late in the process, a lot of publishers will tell you, okay, after you work with the copy editor, all you can do is change typos, nothing that disrupts the layout.
The layout.
Of
okay,
the page,
gotcha.
Right? And they say, and if you do, then we're going to actually have to charge you, which means deduct the money from the millions of dollars that you're going to make. And so there were some changes. I wanted to add whole stories and paragraphs way after I worked with the copy editor, and they were just very nice about it.
Yeah, because your version is thicker. I'm looking at it here on the table. Your version has like about 10 more stories in it than my version. So.
Maybe not 10, but yeah.
Big props to the University of Arizona Press for publishing this book, and they're just amazing people.
Yeah, they published your last book, your last two novels.
Yeah. In fact, maybe one day I should have an interview with them. They publish probably half the authors we've interviewed in this program. They just have some great authors, and they have a great eye and a great ear for stories that I'm a big fan of. But
yeah, you know, in fact, when I got this manuscript, I thought, okay, who do I want to publish this? And they were my first choice. So I sent it to them before I was willing to send it to anybody else. And I figured, well, you know, if they don't want it, I'll go down the list. But fortunately, Scott De Herrera, who is the acquisition editor, loved it and, you know, sent it on to reviewers immediately. Because I think legally, because they're state funded, they need to reviewers. So they hired
reviewers.
Three reviewers to review it. All reviewers were thumbs up.
They were all thumbs up. Man, that's great. That's great. So you're going to have to cover your ears here because I'm going to explain how wonderful. I'm going to lavish all the good stuff. Right now. Yeah. So, and I know how big your head can get. So yeah, if you can cover your ears for me. So what I love about this book is that Kafka in a Skirt, Stories from the Wall is the title. And the stories are witty, smart, complex, but they're also very accessible in that they're funny, they're thought-provoking, and I think that they are just really true to your own voice. And I even felt in many ways that this is kind of a culmination, or at least definitely an evolution from your previous books, that your Unending Rooms, more specifically, even Hotel Juarez, you know, and Chicano Chicanery, like that this is really kind of almost like, I think, you mastering your own sort of interests, form, ideas, all of that. Kafka in a Skirt. Is that a good description of what you're trying to do here with this book?
Well, I would hope that as writers we develop and that we, you know, I mean, I don't want to be as trite to saying we find our voice. I think we, you know, that we're, but I think that we're constantly developing our voice and our vision and who we are. I think that once you stop developing it as a human being, you're pretty much in a, you start to shrink. And so, you know, I want to develop as a human being. I want to develop spiritually, intellectually, morally, and artistically. And so I imagine it would be, if it were the culmination of my artistic creative development, it's only that because it's the latest book I've written. But I would hope that it's part of that progression, that it is in dialogue with earlier collections.
Yeah.
And you know, and that I'm getting better as I go on, you know, or at least I'm you know, learning more about, you know, what it is that that I like to write about.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the things, I mean, because, you know, I know that when I read Unending Rooms, your book that was probably written, what, maybe almost 10 years ago or something? It was quite some time ago. Yeah. Unending Rooms had, you know, this has some of that kind of, I want to say that kind of idea, you know, sort of in this book. It's woven in Kafka in a skirt, but it's so much more than what Unending Rooms was able to do still. It has, you know, there's much more, it's more layered, more complex, and it's including a lot more of the ingredients that I see you involved in and your interests are. Recently, I was at one of your lectures here on campus here at UTEP, and you talked a lot about mysticism, and there's even some of that in here as well. So I'm seeing all of these sort of complexities. So one of the things that I really liked about this book, and what you do in all the books actually, is that you find sort of the humorous and even sort of the strange inside of pop culture. So there's a lot of pop cultural references in your writing, generally speaking, of course, but in this book specifically, in Kafka in a Skirt, there's a lot of that kind of pop culture. So you make references to like just to things that are happening nowadays, you know, happening right now. I mean, for example, technology, you know, some of the technological references, things that are happening today, you know, social media, things like that are referenced in the story. So, you know.
And then the wall itself.
Yeah, the wall itself. But not just that. There are even other things, too, like songs, I think, or stuff like that. There were like references that are happening today.
Right.
But I see that even in your other books, too. Why is that something that is really important to your stories?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. I think maybe it's because I think that the technology that we use, social media, pretty much, you know, everything that we have access to contributes to the way we think about ourselves and the way we think about others.
Right.
So I think that, you know, as I'm writing characters that are, you know, living today, then inevitably they're going to be influenced by, you know, by social media and how they think and how they put together reality. So I don't think I consciously write about popular culture, but I think that it's hard to avoid.
Right.
You know, especially, you know, one of the things that is different now that from even when I first started writing is that we don't lose manuscripts anymore. There's always these stories about writers, you know, working on a manuscript. I think there's one about John Gardner working on a novel, and then he has the manuscript on his motorcycle, and he's driving through the countryside in New England, and the manuscript blows all over the place, and he loses it all. But that doesn't happen anymore, because now every time we write, it's embedded into the cloud. It exists somewhere. And even if we delete it, it still exists somewhere. It's everywhere. Like I have a computer right now, and if I write something, some document, and even if I save it on my desktop, I could access it on another computer, and it's,
right,
and it's there. I could access it on my phone. And I think that really changed a lot of the way we see writing and the way we see reality in itself, is that all these things exist. Even like, for example, if I make a shopping list, I need chorizo, I need bananas, I need a new crack pipe. I mean, yeah. I just list all these things of the stuff that I need.
Right.
And then I delete it. It still exists.
Still exists,
you know,
right.
Not only does my phone carry it for 30 to 60 days, but it's going to be in that cloud.
Right.
And it's kind of scary on some level, because there are these processing machines, these incredible information processing machines that we have no access to, but that companies do have access to, that can not only know everything I have on my shopping list in the last 10 years, but have access to everything I've ever written, every text I've ever, you know. And so it just made reality a lot more different. And it's changed, transformed the way that we see life and the way that we interact with others. And then there's, of course, the neurology behind social media.
Right.
You know, we know, for example, that if you put a post on social media and it doesn't get likes, that it actually affects your neurology, the chemicals in your brain. If you do get a like, you know, it releases serotonin. And this really, you know, has an incredible effect on how we think and how we function on a day-to-day basis. And in part, this book became about how that technology affects the way that we think and affects, you know, our sense of reality. I don't think it was a conscious effort. I think it just, as I started to write the stories, and they you know, they came out one after one, you know, one by one, that I started to make the connections and see,
right,
you know, the importance that technology is, you know, has in how we think about ourselves.
Right. And so, like, I'll take even that description that you just laid out for us right now. The idea, it seems kind of strange. There's a strangeness to it, even a weirdness to it, and even a surrealness to this idea that, you know, you're right. Taking something that is very real, that is happening, and really starting to kind of scrutinize it and analyze it with a powerful lens, a microscope. And you start to, when you start to really look at all the different moving parts within a system, like what you described, you know, we start to see the strangeness in it and even the absurdity. I have to say that is, to me, was an analogy for how the book is written, because you have seemingly normal characters. And I say that, like Bino, for example, from F. Shakespeare, or Kafka in A Skirt, which also is this kind of dude that's kind of almost like Seinfeld. It's like a Seinfeld story, I felt like, in some way.
That's interesting.
You know, he's driving around with his dead girl's books in the back of his car, and you know. So all of these kind of seemingly mundane situations and people, but in their normalness, you find such absurdity when you start to really look at it through this lens. Or the boyfriend and girlfriend who are vegetarians and moved across the street from a meat butcher, a barbecue spot. Like, there is such you really are able to kind of go into that. And I was reminded even a little bit of Julio Cortázar, who does that in some way as well. But I was wondering then, you know, what are you looking for in your subjects, or what, you know, what are you asking of the subjects? And let me frame this really quick before you answer this, because I was in a conversation with Lorian Guerrero, who's in San Antonio, poet there, and I was talking with her about what I've been asking of our subjects, what we ask. So for me, you know, for 20 years that I've been writing, I look at a subject. I can take this book, for example, in front of me, and I would want to know, if I'm going to write about it, I ask questions like, what's its lineage? Where did it come from? What's its history? Those are the kind of questions I've been asking of my subjects for a long time. I'm ready to ask new ones now. But you're not asking those questions. You're asking questions that seem along the lines of, you know, the surrealness or the absurdity within these things. I don't know, but, you know, I guess that's what I'm asking you. What questions, what are you seeking in the subjects when you're writing about them? What are you looking for in them, in the mundane or in the normal?
Right. You know, I think that that's a difficult question. Because I don't think I think of it as necessarily looking for something, but I understand where you're coming from, and I would reframe it and say, you know, what am I willing to? How far am I willing to go?
Right.
You know, what am I willing to uncover? And I think that, you know, when I follow a story, you know, I'm following the language. Like, I mean, you know, I'm on almost any story in here.
Right.
Take the furry spider, for example.
Right.
You know, starts with. You know, with just you know, a voice, and I follow that voice into that, you know, into the situation. This is a case where there's this guy who really believes that his cat, and his cat is named Bacon. It's a Bombay cat, big old black cat that they found in the street, and he really believes that Bacon is bringing spiders to his bed and dropping them on his face as he sleeps, and he gets really paranoid about it, And it just started with that situation. But, you know, as I go deeper into his voice and I follow the thread of his language, I kind of pull out things and understanding that it's not really about the cat Bacon dropping spiders on his face. And, you know, the story reveals that the cat probably isn't even doing that. But it's more about what he's obsessed with and what he fears and what he, you know, doesn't want to reveal about himself or to know about himself. And so rather than going that deeply, he goes into this paranoia that there's, you know, that the cat is bringing up spiders to his bed. And he's so paranoid about it that he can't sleep at night. And he stays up in a chair with a bottle of wine and drinks himself until he falls asleep. And watching Bacon the entire time. And he's so afraid of it. But I think ultimately what I find is that he's not afraid of spiders. He's not really afraid that that's what Bacon's doing. I think he's afraid of facing his own addictions, and that he's, you know, he's afraid of, you know, facing his own reality. And he writes code, and then this character writes code. And so he spends 2 or 3 hours every morning going very deeply into this computer language and creating, you know, a landscape that people access and understand in terms of software, but will never understand the coding behind it.
Right.
And that's kind of how he thinks. And I think that's kind of how we use language in a sense. We use language to write code that creates our reality. But it's not the software. It's not the icon on the desktop that is real. what is real is the language beneath it. And if you go, you know, very, very deeply into one's own language, the way one, you know, not only, you know, uses sentences, but uses rhythm and listens to music and relates to other people in terms of, you know, how you know, on the level of language that what you find is, you know, beyond the persona, beyond what that person thinks that person, how that person understands reality, but you go into something deeper, and oftentimes it's much more complex. It's much more, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of addiction. There's a lot of paranoia in this character. And just on one level, he thinks it's the cat. But I think we do that a lot. We think of reality as being, you know, that which we interact with. But really, we're reacting to things that are deeper than just what we see.
Yeah, and
I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, it totally does. In fact, I think that, I mean, it kind of leads me to another question I had. But, you know, I would say that those themes or those ideas anyways are, you know, throughout the entire book for probably most of the characters. You know, I think there is, like, even I think of the story of the Barbarians, which is the one about the couple who lives across the street from, moves into this place across the street from this barbecue joint. And they're vegetarian. And I think about, there is paranoia in there. There's a sense of even like secrecy. There's a sense of the mystery. And there's also a strong sense underneath all of that. It never is overt, but underneath all of that is vulnerability. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously the man, there's neurosis. The man is, you know, consistently thinking about, you know, how terrible a boyfriend he is if he's, you know, he's going to eat meat, or he dreams of meat. And his girlfriend can smell it on him because she's this hardcore vegan. And so, I mean, there is this kind of worry that's permeating throughout his story as well. But I find that in a lot of the characters, you know, later on too. And then even in the first person narrator at times who's speaking, you sense that as well. One of the things, though, that even with all this kind of complexity of ideas that you have in these stories, and I said this at the beginning of the introduction, the stories are really accessible. And what I mean by that, for the general listener out there, is just that the stories, I mean, anyone, even if you're not interested, if you think you're not interested in reading a book, you can stumble upon this book somewhere, open it up, and just be pulled right into the story, follow it along, laugh out loud, think a little bit. All of that happens within the complexity of the stories that you're making. How important is it for you? Has it always been something, accessibility always been something you've strived for, or is it something you're recently feeling is, you know, and why?
You know, I remember story that somebody told me years ago when I first started writing, you know, and when you're a young writer, you know, and you're a young, you know, intellectual at the university, you know, you want to write about such grand ideas. And I remember talking about an idea that I had, and she told me the story about a poet, a Chinese poet. I don't remember the name of the poet, or even if the story is true, but that the poet, before he let any poem out in public, would go to the lady next door and read it to her. And if she understood it, then he knew it was ready. And I think, you know, that's kind of how I feel about my stories. I don't want the stories to be smart. I don't want the stories to be complex. I don't want the stories to be deeply intellectual. Mm-hmm. I don't want the stories to be mystical. I want the stories to be fun to read. And that's number one for me. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, as you know, I study a lot of mysticism. I study a lot of physics for lay people. I study, I'm even now, you know, studying a lot of esoteric systems and witchcraft, but I just do it for fun. I don't do it because I'm, you know, I take it very seriously. But it's inevitable. If I'm putting together a story, as accessible as that story, you know, can be, I'm creating a landscape. I'm creating a reality, and that reality that I'm creating on the page is maybe 1% of reality. There's so much more reality going on, as in real life, you know, beyond the narrative. And because of what I study, it's inevitably going to make reference to that, whether I'm conscious of it or not. But then in revision, if the story is accessible and if it's good, if it's entertaining, then I could play with the details in such a way that I can give it more complexity, but not so much that a reader needs to understand. If a reader needs to understand the theme of my story, if the reader needs to understand the ideas of the story, then it's not a very good story. I want the reader just to like the stories. And if they do want to re-enter it, then fine, let them re-enter it. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that that it's a good story. That's really, you know, what we remember as kids. You know, we remember good stories. We don't remember important statements that writers are trying to make. And so I really do try to avoid putting statements or ideas before stories. I think number one is language and character.
Right. And in fact, to that idea of enjoyable stories without sort of the without a moral at the end of each one in the story, and I might get the title wrong, the Anne Fortedonna.
I can't pronounce it because it's in Icelandic.
Oh, is that what it is?
The Anne Fortedonna.
Fortedonna. Yeah. Okay. Well, in that is this idea of the gift of desire is the desire itself. Mm-hmm. And I love the story for that. And I felt like that was also kind of an instruction on how to read the stories in general.
Right.
And so, you know, again, I guess another way to say that is it's about the journey and not the destination. But you have all these great stories within that that kind of hint to that as well. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah. I you know, have, you know, been fascinated with the difference between desire and want, because I think that desire is kind of an expansive human experience, that it keeps us alive. Desire, we have desire to live. I mean, if you even watch a baby, the baby wants to live. If you watch a plant, the plant wants to live. I mean, that's our desire. And desire has no image. Desire has no form. Desire has no specific details about it. It's just that general human energy to spread light, to expand. Yeah. That's a really important concept for me. And I think that we confuse desire with want. Want is when you singularize the energy of desire and think that you need to obtain something. And want is creepy. If you've ever been around somebody who wants too much, it's kind of creepy, right? Because they're so focused on, you know, some sort of material possession, even if it's a possession over another person, that it's, you know, you just want to get out of their way. You don't want to be around them. But desire, it, without name, without, you know, without singularizing it to a particular thing, is really what we're all about. We're about desire. We need desire to live. We all have this light in us, and that light has no form. That light has no name. It's just that desire to share the light, right? And so, yeah, I think that's, you know, important that, you know, that my characters have that, you know, that kind of desire. Yeah. And sometimes, however, in fiction, as in real life, a person who is so full of desire, and we all are, channels that desire in sometimes unhealthy ways.
Right. Yeah, that's true. That's right. And, you know, and yet while your books or your stories are about the desire itself, not the sort of end result of acquiring whatever you're after, you utilize this, you know, as a writer, you utilize that desire to acquire as a kind of a tool or device for a compelling read, for a compelling story, to create mystique, to create something for us to chase after in each of these stories. I think of the Alligator Plaza. Is it the title? Alligator Plaza. In which, to me, the whole story is filled with mystery, one after another after another. And almost every sentence you include a sort of a new question of something that we want to chase after. And then there's a couple of sentences later, and then there's like suddenly there's the mystery of an empty beer bottle now, and you're wondering about that. And then you're wondering about this key, and then you're wondering about this code, and it's just pulling you along to the very end. Mm-hmm. I won't reveal these stories because they're just, you know, I don't want to do that. I want you to have that full experience when you read the book. But there is that still, that sort of tool that is pulling us throughout the stories. That is desire very much. We want to get to where is this going? Where is this going?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. You know, I think years ago, I picked up Gödel, Escher, and Bach. It's this incredible book about what strange loops and how there are these strange loops of logic that for some reason pull us in intellectually and spiritually. Like if you listen to, for example, you know, Gödel's, or if you consider Gödel, that he considered, what was his name again? Douglas Hofstadter, that's it. And in this book, he talks about Gödel's mathematical theorem, where you know, if you follow the theorem, it'll kind of contradict itself, and it'll just kind of end up back proving what it proved, what it's saying it's proving. And I don't really understand it because I am really dumb when it comes to math. But he used Bach, you know, and I there was a time in my life where I would only listen to Bach for almost 2 years. That's all I would listen to. But what I love about Bach is his fugue, and how if you follow the fugue, right from the beginning, it starts to, you know, create these different paths, and you follow that path, and then another path starts, but then you end up exactly where you started. And if you look at, you know, an Escher drawing, there's a house, and if you follow the steps of the house going up and up and up, you end up where you started, and it's kind of strange, right. And it's kind of weird. And so this book, Gödel, Escher, and Bach, is all about that. Hofstadter calls it strange loops. And I've always been interested in that idea of the strange loop when it comes to stories, because I think that as story writers, we give, you know, sometimes we give somebody, you know, or we give the reader this, well, okay, well, what's going to happen next? And so then they follow that, and then they, you know, and then something else happens, and then they forget that they wanted to know what happened with the other one, and now want to know what's going to happen right. with this one. And they follow that, and then something changes, and so they forget that they wanted to know that, and so they keep, you know, going on this strange loop, thinking that they want to know what's next, but ultimately it leads you back to where you started, and nothing is resolved. And I really like that idea, and I think in many ways our desires, our wants are like that. We think we want something, we go after it, but then something else grabs our attention. And so I guess, you know, unconsciously or not, that those ideas, you know, kind of come out in right. in the book, because really, if you get what you desire, you're not going to be satisfied. You're going to find something else, you know, and I think that's just the way, that desire is that, you know, energy that gets us there. But then, you know, we just go. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, like desire feeds desire.
It's a strange loop. It's a strange loop, you know, that it really, that's what all plots are. They're strange loops, because once the plot comes to a conclusion and everything is tiny and wrapped up, then the reader forgets about it, you know. And I think that's the difference between popular fiction, a popular novel, and a novel by somebody like Toni Morrison. You get to the end of a Toni Morrison novel, you may not know exactly what happened, but you're going to be thinking about it for a long time. Right. And you get to the end of a pop fiction novel, and it's so tied up so neatly that you're ready to go out and buy the other novel, and you don't have to ever think about it again.
That's right, yeah. And if you're just tuning in to Words on a Wire, I am speaking with my wonderful co-host, Daniel Chacon. We're talking about his new book, Kafka in a Skirt, Stories from the Wall. It's a collection of just fascinating stories, short stories. And, you know, one of the things, Daniel, that I saw in your book that I have never seen you do in any other book before, it's this particular dedication to your daughter.
Oh, well, I didn't have a daughter before.
That's right. That's why you've never done that before. But that said, you know, and knowing you personally, obviously we're friends too. And you know, of talking about how that has sort of just shifted your entire experience of living your life, you know. Right. I know that when I had children, it changed my writing process and even some of the things I was interested in. Has it happened to you? And was any of that involved in, you know, did your daughter having a child or that experience change or make you look at this collection specifically, or if not, any future collection differently, and how so?
You know, she's 6 months old as we're talking right now, and one of the things I would ask people who had kids, you know, especially writers, I would say, well, you know, what happens to your writing time? I remember asking Andrea Cota Botero, who is in our department, and who was an incredibly prolific writer, but she had a kid after her first year here. I didn't really ask you because you were so much younger when you had, you know, you weren't a professor yet.
Because I had three by then. So.
and you know, you were like, had a full-time job and all this. So, you know, I was able to do, you know, dedicate a lot of my time to writing.
Right.
And, you know, I said, Andrea, what do you do with creative time? She goes, you don't get creative time. And I was a little nervous about it. But you know, I take care of the baby. You know, I don't just, you know, say, okay, you know, my wife takes care of it. I mean, I take care of the baby too. And so I wake up in the morning, and I used to get up and I would go to my office. I have a beautiful office, and I would light a candle and I would meditate, and I would do some reading. I would read, you know, these texts on mysticism and all this stuff. Man, I was going so deeply sometimes that I thought I was talking to angels. I swear to God, I would sometimes look out my window and I would see, you know, we have an incredible view, and I would see this great, great mountain way, way far away, so far that it, you know, goes in and out of my view. And I would contemplate that mountain, and I don't know, it was just incredible. And then I would write for about 2 or 3 hours, man. And
after seeing the angels.
After being in that zone and talking to angels, writing for 2 or 3 hours was awesome, you know?
Yeah.
Especially if you don't think about the angels, but you just follow language and follow the story, you know? But when the baby was born, now, you know, my wife watches the baby at night, so I'll watch the baby in the morning so that way she could sleep. So I now when I get up in the morning, I get up with the baby.
Right.
And I take the baby with me upstairs, but I don't light a candle because there's, you know, I don't know how long I'm going to be with the baby. I can't read mysticism. I can't look out at what I have come to call the Hill Mazar, you know, out the window and contemplate it. And I was even creating angels. It was really fun. I had this angelic system that I was creating, you know, just for fun. I mean, I don't take any of it seriously, but I can't do that anymore because I have to watch the baby. And so, you know, I want to interact with the baby. I just don't want to just put the baby there, let the baby cry while I, I write and, you know, think that I'm so important that I have to do my studying and I have to do my writing. So I don't do that. I interact with the baby. But what I found is that, and I've always believed this, and now I know it to be, you know, even more true, but I've always believed that that one of the worst things a writer can do is fragment himself. You know, because if you fragment yourself, and you say, well, no, I'm a professor, and then I'm a, you know, and I'm a this, and I'm a that, and you fragment yourself, then your time for writing is going to be scant. And I try not to think, I try to think of everything I do as a creative act. When I became chair of the department, creative writing, I says, okay, this is a creative act. So what I do for the department, I'm doing for my creativity.
Right.
And it worked because, I mean, I've been publishing even though I'm, I don't find being chair of the department is keeping me from writing. I find, in fact, it's helping me write. And I've published 2 books since I've been chair including this one, I'm still chair. And so, you know, but I thought, okay, but is it going to be true with the baby? And I found it is because I'll put the baby in her little jumper, you know, she'll be jumping around. I'll put on a little song. And like, for example, she has this, this lion and this zebra on her jumper, you know, where it's like a seesaw and she could hit it and the lion will go up and she'll hit the other way and the zebra will go up.
Yes.
And I go, oh, a lion, a zebra, they shouldn't be getting along. Lions eat zebras. And so I started telling a story about why they're friends.
Yeah.
And then, you know, at a certain point, I would do this every day. I would tell her a story. And then I thought, wow, I really should probably write this down, but I can't write because there's a baby. So what I would do and what I do now is every morning when I'm with the baby, I work on another story and I'll speak it into my iPhone dictation app. So in one morning, I'll have a draft of a story. And now I have a collection of stories. And so far I have about, I don't know, 13 stories.
Wow.
And I'm thinking about calling it, I don't know what I'm going to call it yet, but these are stories that I've written for the baby.
Yeah.
And I just talk them into the iPhone. And then later on when I don't have baby duty or the baby is, you know, is asleep, I'll start revising them. And I like these stories a lot because even though they're written for children, they're written in a way that children should be able to access, but in a way that adults will get something out of it too.
Totally.
So I'm almost done with this collection. And
I have one
here. It's called Salamander Girl. This is one of the very first stories I wrote for my baby. And I'll just read you the first lines.
Please, please do.
There was once a baby named Lizzie who went to sleep in her daddy's arms, just like you're about to do now in my arms. When she woke up, she felt hungry as normal, but what she found out next was not normal at all. She was no longer a little girl. She was a salamander. Imagine waking up to find out you turned into a salamander. What's a salamander, you might ask? Good question. And so the baby who wakes up as a salamander gets a view of herself in the mirror and has no idea what she is. But she starts to go around to different, you know, like she goes to the cat and says, what am I?
Right.
And the cat like says, you're food. And the cat starts to chase her. And then she'll go to the dog. What am I? And the dog will say, you're a toy. And, you know, so she's spending the whole time going around trying to find out who she is. But then so anyway, you know, the point is I'm loving writing these stories.
Yeah.
So has it my writing changed? Absolutely.
Yes.
I have quit studying mysticism since I've been with this baby just because I don't have time.
Right.
I have quit studying esoteric systems and physics ever since I've had this baby. I have no time. And so, yeah, but I'm loving it, and I don't feel like it's taking anything away. If anything, I think it's enhancing my creativity, and this is where I'm supposed to be. So these stories that I'm writing, I'm going to put her as co-author since
Very good, man.
She's
that's
there.
Great. And, you know, that's just another form of – that's actually – you know, that's actually the lived form of mysticism and angelic systems, you know, you working with the baby, you know, yeah. It really is. And you come to so much discovery, as you know. And well, that's exciting. And, you know, I know you and I will continue this conversation because you have a reading actually coming up on October 20th. Literarity.
Yeah.
Here at Literarity at the bookstore. Yeah. And so we're gonna be in conversation a little bit there. And then we'll celebrate your release. And hey, it's just been really great talking to you about your book. And I'm excited for you and the baby, who has a beautiful name. Can we say her name?
Of course.
Lucinda?
Yes.
Oh, man, she has a beautiful name. And so
Lucinda Jolene. She's named Lucinda after my mother, her grandmother, whom unfortunately she will never meet in this mm-hmm. life. And Jolene, after her maternal grandmother, whom she also will never meet in this
right.
life. But she'll carry their names.
Well, here's to her and to you. So congratulations again, man.
Thank you.
Absolutely. And that wraps it up for this edition of Words on a Wire. I'd like to thank my special guest and co-host of our program, Daniel Chacon. And, well, hopefully we'll see you next week, same time, same place, right here on KTEP 88.5 FM.